Open your Bible to the book of James, James chapter number 1. I know we got our Awana kids in here tonight, our teenagers are here tonight, so I'm going to make it a fun night and an encouraging night. I'm going to talk about some things that have happened along the way in our life, and I trust that there'll be an encouragement to you. In the book of James, there are 9 attitudes that are found in the book of James. I'm only going to deal with the first attitude. It's the attitude that is first mentioned in James chapter 1 and verse number 2. And you'll see the attitude word there in that verse. It begins by saying, "My brethren, count it all joy." Say that word with me. Joy. Say it again. Joy. Say it joyfully. Joy. "My brethren, count it all joy." Notice this. "When you fall into diverse temptations." Now, the temptations being spoken of there is not talking about being tempted unto sin, but rather it's talking about problems. It's talking about trouble. It's talking about tribulation. It's talking about situations in life that are less than desirable. So let me ask you a question. How many of you have ever had anything in your life that you consider to have been less than desirable? Would you hold your hand in the air? Okay, how many of you had something this week that you considered to have been less than desirable? All right. How many of you had something today that you consider to be less than desirable? What I am talking about is a fact of life. Things are not going to go the way you want them to go all the time. But the Bible says to the child of God, there's an attitude that one should have even in those situations. Now imagine the attitude. I'm having a bad day, but I still have joy. Well, read on. In the next verse, it says this. It says, "Knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience." Yeah, I need more patience. More patience toward my kids. More patience toward my mate. More patience toward those I work with. Yes, I need more patience. Are there those who could use more patience from time to time? Would you hold your hand in the air? Well, wonderful. I've got good news for you. You can become a more patient person as you have more problems, as you have more trials, as you have more tribulations. I mean, face it. When you're on the mountaintop, you do not need patience. When everything's going your way, you do not need patience. The only time you'll grow in patience is when things are not going your way. But notice verse 4, but, transitional word there, but let patience have her perfect work. In other words, when the problems come, and they will, don't fly off the handle and say things you ought not say. Don't take matters into your own hands and do things you ought not do. But just back up and be patient and see what God is going to do through the situation. Notice, but let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. In other words, there are benefits that come our way when we remain under a situation that's less than desirable in a way that honors God and in a way that honors our faith. So we find the word joy. Hold your finger there. We'll come back to the area in just a moment. But turn to Romans chapter 5 and see the attitude expressed yet a second time with different words. Romans chapter 5, beginning with verse number 2. Romans 5, 2. "By whom also we have access by faith into this grace wherein we stand and rejoice." Say that word. Rejoice. "Rejoice in the hope of the glory of God, and not only so, but we glory." Say that word, glory. We have 3 words. We have joy, we have rejoicing, and now we have glorying. 3 words. Notice this, glory in tribulation also. So all 3 of these words that express an attitude are surrounded in this area of bad things happening. Joy, rejoicing, glorying. Now imagine the attitude. I'm having a bad day, but I have joy. Well, I'm rejoicing. This is the worst week I have ever had. And glory, it doesn't look like it's going to get any better. This is a strange attitude. It seems to be a paradox. But read on. We begin in verse 4, or in verse 3, and not only so, but we glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope, and so forth. Now go back to the book of James and turn over just one page to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6. The attitude is expressed yet again to the Christian. We're to have joy. We're to have rejoicing. We're to have glorying. And now notice in 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 6, we're going to add to our rejoicing. Wherein ye greatly rejoice. Okay, we're adding to our rejoicing. Wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations. The manifold temptations are those problems that seem to compound themselves one upon the other. Have you ever had a day where nothing went right? You said, I've had weeks like that. One problem compounding itself upon the other. In this passage, isn't it interesting that it seems to indicate the more problems you have, the more you ought to rejoice? Now that doesn't make any sense. But read on and notice this in verse 7, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto the praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. One day we stand before God and we give an account for how we handled the bumps in the road. For many of the trials, many of the problems that came into our life came with an express purpose of molding us into the image of Christ. It's the attitude by which we faced those situations that perhaps determined whether God's work was completed or whether it was rejected. Joy, rejoicing, glorying, great rejoicing. Why does the Bible say this should be the Christian's attitude? I'm going to explain some things, perhaps, that will give us insight into it. Some things that took place in our life, my wife and I, our family. A number of years ago, we were praying for a travel trailer. The one that we had lived in for so many years had gotten smaller. As the boys had gotten larger, we needed something larger. And to make a long story short, a glorious story, God provided for us a brand new travel trailer, free and clear. A man who was dying of cancer, whom I had never met, had me come over to his house, and he wrote a check in excess of $87,000 toward the trailer. It may well have been the largest trailer in the United States at the time. It was 47 feet long, with 5 electronic slide-out rooms, 13 feet 6 inches high, the same size as a semi. Now, I had a truck that I was pulling my former trailer with. It was a Dodge Dreamer. It looked like a tow vehicle. It was a van in the front, truck in the back, used out west. A lot of farmers use it with their cattle trailers. And everybody said, you know, your truck will never pull that trailer. Your truck's too small. Trailer's too big. So I started asking professionals their advice. Everybody concurred the engine would be strong enough, 440 engine, but the weak link would no doubt be the transmission. So I took it to South City, San Francisco, to a transmission shop, and I said, look, can you beef this up? He said, oh, yeah, when we get through with it, nothing will destroy the transmission I put in your truck. So confidently, I left it with him. By the end of the week, he called me back and said the truck was ready. I walked to the counter. He handed me the bill. He handed me the bill for $1,400, and I looked at that bill, and I didn't have a lot of joy when I saw it. And I wasn't rejoicing, and I wasn't saying, glory, what a bill this is. But I'm just writing the check, and I flippantly say, well, I guess that truck will pull that trailer now, won't it? He said, Steve, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? Don't you know how much $1,400 is? I want to know! Oh, at that moment, I could jump up on the counter and rearrange his face with my feet. Or I could tell him off and say things I ought not say as a Christian. But let me ask you a question. If I say things I ought not say, will that make my transmission stronger? Yes or no? And if I do things I ought not do, will that make my transmission stronger? Nothing I say, nothing I do changes the situation. I have learned in a situation like this that it might well be the best thing the Christian can say. Oh, well. I want you to say those two words with me because you might need them this week. Let's say them together. Oh, well. When things aren't going the way you want them to go, just back up and patiently say, oh, well. Let's see what God is going to do through this situation that'll be a benefit to me. Well, I drove to Concordia, Missouri. Walt Brock from Ironwood Camp was already there and was going to follow me back to California. And Walt said, hey, Steve, before we leave, let's just hook it up, go down the interstate and come back, make sure it works. Good idea. We hooked it up. I got out on the interstate, 30, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour. I had joy. I had rejoicing. Oh, I was glorying. This truck is going to work. We turned around. We came back to the very ramp we departed from. I got out of the truck, walked back behind the trailer to Walt's car. Walt, it's working great. Good. Hit the road to California. 5 miles later. 5 miles later, smoke starts boiling out from under the truck. I have blown the $1,400 transmission. What do you say in a moment like that? Yeah. I've seen people with their vehicles. They'll have a flat tire. What do? They kick it. Ah, flat tire. What good does that do? It hurts the foot, but puts no air in the tire. Or they have a car that will not start, and they bang on the dashboard. That really helps. Or they get out and open the hood, and they don't know why they did that. They don't understand anything up under there. You can tell your car off, and it still won't start. Well, we call for a wrecker. I said I need a big wrecker. I'm 66 feet long from the front of my truck to the back of the trailer. I'm the same size as a semi. They said, we'll send one. We waited and waited. And finally, this little bitty pickup came with a little bitty boom on the back of it. It is the smallest wrecker I have ever seen in my life. I thought he was just passing by, stopping to see if he could lend assistance. But it was he who they sent. I said, you're not going to try to pull that with that, are you? He said, I can pull your rig. So he backed it up, jacked it up, hooked it up in a way I've never seen done. He did not use a chain. I had an air damper that hung very close to the ground. He was scared that he might mar it or tear it off. And so he cradled the two front tires in nylon straps. I got in his wrecker. We drove off. I'll confess, I was impressed. His little bitty wrecker pulled my whole rig. We could not carry on a conversation, however. It was wide open and barely moving, but it was moving. We went down the interstate just a few miles, and we got off the interstate and went down the ramp to the stop sign. There was an important word there. We went down. As we were going down, the massive weight of the trailer took control of everything. It was pushing the truck. He was trying to stop it. It snapped the straps and drove the front end of my beautiful Dodge Dreamer into the back end of his wrecker and bashed the whole thing in. What do you say in a moment like that? I'll never forget what he said. When he got out of the wrecker and walked around and saw the front end of my truck bashed in, he said, oops. Oops. What do you mean, oops, you incompetent wrecker driver? Look what you've done to my truck. Or I could pound him into the ground. But that would not have changed a thing. Oh, I could tell him off and say things I ought not say as a Christian. But that wouldn't change a thing. Oh, well. Let's see what God's going to do in this situation that becomes a benefit to me. He hooked it up again using the same nylon straps. Double wrap around the tire. He says that'll hold it. And we got back in the wrecker and drove off. We turned to the left, went under the interstate, went up the hill to the stoplight. We're just sitting there. Pow! The straps snapped again. I looked out the window, and there go the truck and trailer leaving the wrecker all by themselves. Cars behind it, peeling off to the right and left. Not one thing I can do. Watch out! Here it comes! And there it goes, in excess of $90,000, and I've never spent one night in it. He jumped out of the wrecker and started running after it. It's at a moment like this, I could take matters into my own hands. Hold it! Wrecker driver, stop! Front and center now! I've had it with you! Would that have helped? No. Best thing I can do is let him keep running in case he can catch up with it. Sometimes our words hinder the process rather than help them. I had a strange thought watching him run down the road. I wonder if I locked the door. I had not. He caught up with it. He jumped in and stopped it. It hit nothing, hit no one. The most amazing thing, it went just as straight backwards down that road as it could go. Those things don't back straight by themselves. They don't back straight when you're trying to back them straight. Well, he went up to the top of the hill, got his wrecker and brought it down and hooked it up a third time. This time he used a chain. I like chains. The reason he could use a chain was by this time he's torn the whole front end off my truck. You can hook a chain anywhere you want to. You got full access to the frame. We dropped the trailer off in Blue Springs, Missouri, and the next day took the truck to a transmission shop. They were convinced this truck should work. So they rebuilt the transmission. 3 days later, I tried pulling again. I went 8 miles and blew that transmission. They're still convinced it should work. They rebuilt it, put a bigger pump. 3 days later, we tried pulling again. I went 5 miles, blew that transmission. 3 transmissions, and I haven't even left town yet. I finally figured it out. This truck won't work. So I put the 4th transmission in and drove back to California and left the trailer. I hired Morgan Transfer Company to deliver the trailer. They charged me $1,800 for the delivery. $1,800, a bill I did not expect. $1,800, a bill I did not want. How many of you have ever gotten a bill you did not expect? A bill you did not want? Would you hold your hands in the air? What'd you say when you got it? No, you did not. I was waiting for the trailer to be delivered. Actually, it was a week that I was to be here doing a revival at Fairfax Baptist Temple, but I had gotten sick and the trailer was coming at the same time. I got a telephone call. Is this Steve Piggott? Yes, it is. This is Morgan Transfer Company. We're dropping your trailer in Kingman, Arizona. We blew the engine in our truck, and we're not pulling this trailer another inch. What do you mean you're dropping my trailer in Kingman, Arizona? I paid you $1,800. I want my trailer! Let me ask you a question. Have you ever expressed your will? Sometimes our will can be expressed in the oddest of places. A restaurant. We're not getting the service we think we deserve. And we can let the people know of our displeasure by our words, by our actions, by our attitude, or sometimes even by the tip or the lack thereof, expressing our will. Oh, yeah, I could wrap the telephone cord around his neck and strangle him, but it would not get the trailer delivered. Now, have you noticed the compounding of one problem upon the other? And it seems there's no end in sight. Manifold temptations. An evangelist friend of mine, Harvey Seidel, had just bought the largest Dodge truck with the biggest Cummins engine in it. And he had bragged to me, "Steve, this truck will pull anything." So I called him. "Hey, Harvey, how is your truck doing?" "Oh, it's great. Harvey, I've got a trailer in Kingman, Arizona. Do you think your truck would pull my trailer into San Francisco?" "Sure." "Good." We went and got it. And it did. pulled it across the mountains into San Francisco. Not a problem. Less than 1 week later, I got a call from Harvey. Steve? Yes, sir? I'm having to put a new transmission in my new truck. I blew his transmission too. It's at this point you need to hear and learn a valuable lesson. When he told me that, it would have been wrong for me to have said, oh well. Understand the words I'm using tonight are not public words. They're private words. In the quietness of your own spirit, when things aren't going the way you want them to go, you just back up and patiently say, oh well, let's see what God is going to do through this situation that'll be a benefit to me. But these are not words you use to someone else. A husband and wife are having difficulty in marriage, and she says, these are the things you do that bother me. He should not say, oh well. I went to the eye doctor just a few years after we had been here in Fairfax just to get new contacts. When I got the new contacts, I said, Doc, these are no different. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, let me describe it to you like this. If I close my right eye and look at you out of my left eye, everything is okay. But if I close my left eye and look at you out of my right eye, doctor, your head is gone. I could look at my hand. I could see the palm, but I couldn't see my fingers. I'd look at a picture on the wall. I could see some of the picture, but not all of it. You know, there are a lot of people that look better without a head. I had a lot of fun with that just for a few days. They sent me for testing. It is unbelievable what they can do to your eye while it's still in your head. For 3 hours, they sent all these tests that they were doing on me. And Sarah was sitting out in the waiting room. And Doc said, would you like for her to join us? I thought he was being kind. But he gave us the news. He said, we've got a problem. He said, you have no options. The only option is enucleation. I didn't even know what that word meant. Take the eye out, and we recommend it immediately. What do you say at a moment like that? That's where the thought comes from for tonight. Because the first words out of my mouth. Oh, well. You see, what I'm talking about tonight, I'm talking about the things over which you have no control. And there are going to come things in your life over which you have absolutely no control. There's nothing you can say, nothing you can do that changes the situation. It's just there. I'll never forget when I left the meeting in Stone Mountain, Georgia, to come back to Washington, D.C. Are you ready for this? For my outpatient surgery. I was not admitted to the hospital. I went to the hospital. They took the eye out. And 3 hours later, I went home. It's a minor procedure nowadays. Ron Hamilton, when he had his eye removed in Emory, he was in the hospital 8 days. That was 40-some odd years ago. I was in the hospital 3 hours. I'll never forget the day. I walked up to a lady. I said, I'm Steve Piggott. I'm here for surgery. She couldn't find my name anywhere. Maybe they have your paperwork downstairs. So I go downstairs to another person and say, hello, I'm Steve Piggott. I'm here for surgery. She said, yes, we've been expecting you. She opened my file and she said the strangest thing. Now, Mr. Piggott, what are you having done today? What does the file say I'm having done? I said, ma'am, I'm having an eye removed. Oh, that sounds serious. Yes, ma'am, I guess so. Which one? You ever want to just get in your car and go home? Come back on another day when everybody knows what we're actually doing? Well, I wanted to make sure the doctor knew. When Dr. Perman came in, he said, Steve, how are you doing? I said, I'm doing fine, but I have a question. What's that? Which eye are we removing? The right one. Uh-huh. Is that your right or my right? That makes a difference when you're facing somebody. He said, you're right. You have a pen in your pocket? Yeah, take it out. Draw an arrow right there. When he left, I wondered if he'll remember what the arrow is for. Is that the one I leave or is that the one I take out? Well, he got the right one. When we were leaving, he told my wife, the only thing Steve will need is Tylenol. He missed that one. When I got home, whatever they had given me wore off and my head started hurting. She called for medicine and he said, okay, I'll put in order for Percocet. I like Percocet. I took Percocet for 3 days. I didn't even know I had eyes. I didn't even know I had a head for 3 days. I used to preach, I have never done drugs. Can't preach that one anymore. I've done Percocet. But you know, by the end of the same week, Bobby Finch and Rob Diaz were on the road headed to our next meeting in Vancouver, Canada. We had not told the people that I was coming wearing a patch, had not told the people I'd had surgery. That night, we were setting up the sound equipment. One of the ladies at the church walked up to Mr. Diaz, the piano player, and she says, oh, I'm so sorry Mr. Piggott lost his eye. Is that going to affect his vision? Duh. You know, and lady, poke your eye out with an ice pick. Does that affect your vision? Well, sure it affects your vision. I don't see my hand right there. I can make everybody here disappear. They're gone. So many hilarious things have happened since I've lost my eye. I've had so much fun with one eye, I'm thinking about taking the other one out. I mean, it's got to be a blast. At the same meeting, I go back to the motel room. I'm unpacking. I had forgotten my contact case and my contact solution. I knocked at Bobby's door and said, Bobby, can we go out? I need to go to a grocery store and find some contact solution, contact case. It was probably midnight. We're at this grocery store. I find contact solution, but I couldn't find a contact case anywhere. And I said, ma'am, do you have anything I can use? She says, I can get some bottles from the pharmacy. Well, thank you. So she goes away and she comes back with two of them. She sets them on the counter. She opens a drawer. Very kind lady. Takes a magic marker. She's about to write on them. And I said, ma'am, look at me. I don't think I'm going to need but one of those bottles. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll just put a L on this one. Oh, well, thank you. That will help me keep it straight. One eye, one contact. I don't get it confused anymore. Oh, it's gone on and on and on. I've told this young story to the young people. I was flying back to Washington, D.C. from Ironwood Camp. I was at the Las Vegas airport one night. I was taking the red-eye flight back home and in the midnight flight, and I wasn't wearing my patch. Now, you always see me with a patch because usually when I'm in public, I wear a patch. I've got a drainage issue that they've never been able to solve. I do have a fake eye. It looks real. It looks normal. It looks natural. But I've got the drainage issue. But there are times I don't wear the patch. Sometimes when I'm out working, I don't wear the patch. I'm in the sun. I don't want to get that white spot, you know, right there. Tan everywhere else, white spot. And so I don't wear the patch outside when I'm working. I don't wear the patch at home. My wife understands the situation. My boys understood the situation. And sometimes when I get on a plane late at night, I do not wear the patch. Because all I'm going to do is get on the plane and go to sleep. And I love doing this. Because this eye does not close. So I lay back in the seat. I'm sound asleep with one eye wide open staring at everybody. I've had people shake me. They think I had a heart attack or a stroke. I said, I'm just trying to sleep. Yeah, but your eye's wide open. Yeah. I like to keep an eye on you while I'm sleeping. So that night I walked up to the counter, United Airlines, and I noticed there was a flight coming to the Washington Dulles Airport. I had actually been scheduled for Baltimore on that flight. And I said, can I get on that plane instead? It's easier for my wife to pick me up when I get home. Yes, you can, but you'll have to hurry to get on that flight. And I'm running through the airport. Looked like a normal person with two eyes running through the airport, and I ran over a lady. I never saw her. She came out of the right side. I was running through. Wham! And unfortunately, I hit her hard. And she turned on me. Oh, did she let me have it? I said, ma'am, I am so sorry, but I did not see you. You had to have seen me. She just chewed on me like a little chihuahua. I said, ma'am, honestly, I did not see you. She would not turn it loose. I thought, well, that's enough of this. I just reached up and I took my eye out. I said, ma'am, honestly, I didn't see you. And I pointed my eye toward her, but I see you now. You say, Brother Steve, you ought not do that. I know. But I paid thousands of dollars for this eye, and I think I have the right to have fun with it if I want to. I came home one day to the Washington Dulles Airport. It would be a while before Sarah got there to pick me up. So I went into the red carpet room, United Airlines. When I walked in, there was a lady sitting behind the desk wearing a medical bandage on her eye. Her name is Sharon. She's helped me with tickets for years. I walked up to the counter. I said, Sharon, what's the problem? She says, well, I'm facing eye surgery. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. When you have been through a situation, you want to be a help and encouragement to those who are going through the same situation. I wanted to be an encouragement to her. What's the issue? She says, they've discovered a growth in my eye, and they do not know if they'll be able to treat it or if I'm actually going to have my eye removed. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. You know, I went through the same thing. Well, I know you started wearing a patch, but I've never known why. Well, they discovered a growth in my eye. The only problem was for me, it was on the optic nerve. And there was no way that they could treat the eye without destroying it anyway. So the best option for me was just to have the eye removed. But it's not a big deal. Actually, it's a minor procedure. You go to the hospital, they take it out. You get a new eyepiece. And honestly, the eyepieces move and track. They look so real, so normal. Probably no one would ever know you even had the surgery done. I said, would you like to see my eye? And she said, well, yes. So I did what I always do. I turned around, took my handkerchief, and I cleaned the eye to make it presentable. And I turned back around, and I lifted the patch to show her. And she looked and turned away. And she would not look back. I told her how natural it looks. The fact that it moves and tracks. Nobody would ever know that you had the surgery. But she would not look. And I thought, that's odd. No one's ever done that before. Eventually, I lowered the patch, continued to console her, and eventually I had to leave. I took the tram, came over to the main terminal. I couldn't get in my mind, why wouldn't she look? Oh, man. I wonder if when I cleaned it, I turned it and showed it to her crooked. So I walked into a men's room, walked up to a mirror, lifted the patch, and sure enough, that eye's looking up over there like that. One eye's looking straight ahead, one eye's looking out the top of her head, and I told her how natural it looks. I told her nobody would even know that you had the surgery done. Oh, I felt so bad, but I couldn't get back through security. 3 days later, I'm at the airport again. Immediately, I go to the red carpet room. I walk in, she's sitting there. I said, Sharon, I've got to apologize to you. Why? I had no idea when I showed you my eyepiece that I had turned it and showed it to you crooked. She says, oh, I don't think a thing about it. Because when you walked out those doors, I thought to myself, there goes the most positive man I've ever met in my life. If you thought that eye looked good. She said, that was the most horrendous thing I've ever seen. Now, I don't know if you catch on. I suspect you do. I do not have a problem having one eye, and I never have. My boys can tell you, my wife can tell you, Bob and Rob traveling with me can tell you, it hasn't been a problem for me since day one. I tell you what I attribute it to. An attitude. I'm here to say this. No matter what the difficulty, no matter what the problem, no matter how many times it may compound itself upon the other, I'm here to say that as long as we have the right attitude, everything's going to come out okay. But I'm also here to remind us that if we have the wrong attitude, it will eat you alive. It's that little voice in you that keeps jabbering away and jabbering away. How that this is not right. How that you've been mistreated. Just jabbering away. And that attitude can turn into bitterness. You know, I could have cancer in my body today. That was one of the concerns when they were removing the eye, that they could release cells in my body. I've been through the cancer checks. As far as I know, I have no cancer. But I could have cancer in my body today. But far better would that cancer be than the cancer of bitterness that eats at the soul. In the 40 plus years of ministry, I have seen how people have responded in difficulties. I know family members today who do not speak to one another because one day somebody did something the other did not like, and all of a sudden words were exchanged, actions were done, and all of a sudden this root of bitterness springs up so that family members, brothers and sisters, have not spoken to one another in years. I know people who had been in the same church, and because something did not go the way they wanted it to go in church, words were exchanged, and all of a sudden there's this breach between them, and they no longer even darken the door of a church. It is amazing how far bitterness can go. I know people who've been mad at God. God, this is not fair. I don't deserve the things I'm going through. And they say things to God they ought not say and do things they ought not do. I believe it's at a time like this when one should consider the prayer of the psalmist. Lord, renew a right spirit within me. It's an interesting verse. I'll come back to it in just a moment. Why does the Bible say we ought to have joy? Why does the Bible say there ought to be rejoicing? Why does the Bible say there ought to be glory and even great rejoicing in tribulation, in trouble, in difficult situations? Two reasons, much without explanation. Number one, the book of Nehemiah says, the joy of the Lord is my strength. Lose your joy and you lose your effectiveness as a child of God. The joy of the Lord is my strength. And perhaps if there were no other reason, my testimony is at stake. Imagine I'm on the mountaintop. Woohoo! There's joy here and rejoicing glory. It's wonderful when everything is going my way. That's the way everyone acts on the mountaintop. Let's imagine I'm in some of the deepest, darkest waters I have ever been in my life. And yet, in the midst of these dark waters, I still have peace and contentment and joy in my relationship with God, knowing that there's not anything that has taken Him by surprise. People on the outside begin to look in and they say, I don't understand. What is it that upholds this individual? How can he have joy and peace and contentment when all of these problems are around him? I'm convinced that our testimony shines at its brightest when we're in the valley. Much brighter than when we're on the mountaintop. Sometimes our testimony is marred or perhaps destroyed because we've said things we ought not to have said or done things we ought not to have done. Notice again what the psalmist said. Renew a right spirit within me. But watch what happens in this verse. Verse 10, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not from thy presence. Take not thy Holy Spirit from me. Watch it carefully. Restore unto me the joy. Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. And uphold me with thy free spirit. What happens as a result of that? What happens as a result of having this right spirit? Then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. Our testimony shines at its brightest when we have joy and when we have a right spirit. I had preached this message in Land of Lakes, Florida. Rick Averett was going home Sunday night. His 4-year-old daughter sitting in the back seat. Daddy, can we stop at McDonald's? No, we got to get home. Oh, Daddy, please, can we stop at McDonald's? No, we've got to get home. Daddy, please stop at McDonald's. No. They drove by McDonald's and the 4-year-old sat in the back of the car watching it go by. Oh, well. It's a good attitude for young people. When mom and dad tell us we can't do some things we want to do, we ought to have the right spirit. It's a good attitude no matter how old we are. I spoke at Maranatha Baptist Bible College, and they asked me to bring the message, and a 5-year-old boy sat on the front row, one of the staff member's sons, because on Monday morning he was having his eye removed, and they wanted him to hear the message. The next day he goes to the doctor. The doctor says to the 5-year-old boy, "Son, you have anything you want to say? You know this is a serious surgery. Anything you want to say?" Oh, well, I'm sure that doctor had no clue why he said that. So tomorrow, if things do not go the way you want them to go, in the quietness of your own spirit, just back up and say, "Oh, well, I'm not going to let the situations rob me of my joy. I'm not going to let the situations rob me of my effectiveness. And I'm not going to let the situations ruin my testimony." My brethren, count it all joy.